This episode is supported by Deep Dive with Laura Arnold, a podcast exploring today's most pressing issues, like the politics that stymie gun violence prevention, the accountability crisis in higher education, and creating equal access to birth control. Laura Arnold shares the mic with data-driven experts to examine the elusive fixes for our nation's broken systems. Just tap your search bar and look for Deep Dive with Laura Arnold. Our thanks to Deep Dive for their support. Reveal is brought to you by Progressive. Have you tried the Name Your Price tool yet? It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to find a rate that works for you. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive. Get your quote today at Progressive.com and see why 4 out of 5 new auto customers recommend Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. The wildfire season started early this year, which has people worried that it could be as bad as last year. And for people like me who live on the West Coast, well, that's terrifying because last year's wildfire season was horrific. Dim orange skies, air that was dangerous to breathe, and ash falling from above for weeks on end, not to mention the actual fires themselves. Here in California, more than 4 million acres, an area bigger than Connecticut, were incinerated. There were record-setting fires all over the West. This is Oregon Governor Kate Brown on CBS's Face the Nation.
Every year for the last 10 years, we burn about 500,000 acres. This year, this week alone, we've burned over 1 million acres of beautiful Oregon.
When the governor talks about beautiful Oregon, she's talking about places like Mill City in the western foothills of the Cascade Mountains. It's surrounded by towering forests.
I want to say about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, I started hearing our fire whistle blow off in town.
Tim Kirsch is the mayor of Mill City.
I'm telling people that are in their driveways need to pack up and go, or at least be ready to go in just the, in an instant.
Mill City was largely spared, but the towns surrounding it were leveled. Every year that we see massive fires like that one, the debate picks up over the best ways to keep our forests from going up in smoke. Some argue we need to cut down more trees to prevent fires and plant saplings that will soak up carbon. Others argue our history of logging is the problem. They say we should cut down fewer trees and use fire as a tool to help young forests grow into old ones. Both sides believe their plans would help reverse climate change, even though they have opposite ways of getting there. To really understand this debate, we have to step back 30 years to when this fight over the forest began. The podcast series Timber Wars, produced by Oregon Public Broadcasting, is about how the fight over old-growth forests and a bird called the Northern Spotted Owl helped turn environmental conflicts into culture wars over how we manage our forests today. Today, we're re-airing a show they produced for us from earlier this year. Reporter Aaron Scott starts the story with a protest that became known as the Easter Massacre.
The Pacific Northwest has an image. For many folks, it's one shaped by episodes of Portlandia. You know, lots of Subarus, brunch lines, and flannel. Also, 90s grunge music and tech giants like Microsoft and Amazon. But before all that, the Pacific Northwest was a sleepier place, a damp corner of the country, largely outside the national spotlight. It was a region dominated by a single industry, logging.
I started in the timber industry basically out of high school.
Stephen Weaver lives in Staten, Oregon. For a lot of his life, he worked as a tree faller, also called a timber cutter. Basically, it was his job to cut down colossal trees with a chainsaw and shout, timber.
Yeah, you had a lot of pride in what you did. Some of 99% of the timber cutters did. There was that 1 or 2% that were just there for the buck. But some of the best timber cutters came out of the Detroit Canyon.
Detroit Canyon is inside Oregon's Willamette National Forest. It's home to some of the biggest and oldest trees in the world. Douglas fir, western red cedar, western hemlock. They can tower 300 feet into the air and stand 8 feet wide. They feel like pillars holding up the sky, which is maybe why folks who saw them disappearing felt like the sky was falling.
Where it really all started was that North Roaring Devil sale. And
it's impossible to pin down exactly when the timber wars started, because they had a different beginning for everyone involved. For Stefan, it was in 1989, in these forests, at a timber sale called the North Roaring Devil.
There were a lot of things that went on up there.
Back in March of 1989, Detroit Canyon was blanketed in snow. Still, Stefan's bosses wanted him in there, cutting.
We were snowmobiling in. We'd have to make 2 or 3 trips, you know, because we didn't have a dozen snowmobiles, but it was just a mess.
The U.S. Forest Service makes up names for the various timber sales. The trees Stefan was cutting were part of a sale called the North Roaring Devil, and it was controversial. That's a lot of why he was riding into those woods by snowmobile.
They didn't want to plow the roads so these other people could walk or drive in.
By other people, he means environmentalists. They had been fighting in court to stop the logging of the giant centuries-old trees. Stefan was under pressure to get the job done fast.
Then on Saturday night before Easter, Jim Morgan called me up.
Jim Morgan was Stefan's boss at one of the biggest timber companies in the canyon. And he said, I need 10 men.
I need them tomorrow morning, Sunday morning. I said, it's Easter, Jim. He says, I don't care. I want 10 cutters in the morning, and you'll be compensated very well for it.
So what was with the rush? Well, there was a court date on Tuesday, and there was fear the judge could side with environmentalists and put this logging on hold. So the fallers were racing to cut the trees first.
Because once it was on the ground, it was kind of a done deal.
So on Easter morning, Stefan and his crew got up before dawn, piled into their trucks pulling snowmobiles, and headed into the woods, where they were met with a surprise.
Logging crews arrived at 5:30 this morning to find 30 protesters who sealed off the entrance to the site.
The protesters were standing shoulder to shoulder across the road and holding signs stating Save Our Old Growth and Earth First. The loggers stopped and discovered the media was there, too.
This morning, a confrontation seemed possible, but both sides chose to talk about the issues rather than fight over them.
You know, I think this is kind of a...
It's not productive.
Yeah, this argument is...
Well, I don't think anything's productive. Do you think this is being productive? I got a crew of men I'm paying to be productive.
In the news footage, you can see Stefan standing in the group of loggers, and he looks annoyed.
We could talk to them and they could talk to us, but our views were dramatically different about the situation. So at that time, there wasn't any middle ground, you know. They just didn't want that timber cut. They didn't want any timber cut.
Stefan and the loggers had been hired to cut the trees, but they weren't the protesters' real target. That was the logging company that bought the timber, and the U.S. Forest Service, which made the sale. Many people today might think the Forest Service is all about taking care of forests. But its main job at the time, particularly in the Northwest, was selling trees to the highest bidder. For most of the 20th century, foresters and the government viewed trees as crops. The plan was to harvest the last of these ancient giants and replant them with saplings. But for protesters, these trees had a completely different value.
I drove here in 85, and all I knew about Oregon was that there were lumberjacks and big trees, so I stopped and fell in love with it and never left.
Katia Juliana moved to Eugene for college. The city was a hotbed for liberal activism. The day before Easter, she went to a nonviolence training, and just as it was ending, someone rushed in and said they needed people to protect some ancient trees. So Katia volunteered.
We arrived about midnight, and it was full-on stuff was happening. There was people with walkie-talkies greeting us.
Activists have been fighting for years to stop logging in this area. It included groves of ancient trees that were so beautiful, folks thought of them in sacred terms, referring to them as cathedral forests. And they were willing to put their lives on the line to protect them because scientists had started to establish what many nature lovers already felt. These were not just crops. They were complex ecosystems that played vital roles, filtering water and slowing floods, and providing essential habitat for hundreds of creatures, from songbirds to salmon. Trees also reduce greenhouse gases by pulling carbon dioxide out of the air and storing it in their trunks and needles. And the biggest 1% of trees store 50% of the forest carbon. But of course, knowing you want to save the trees is different from knowing how to do it. To Katya, it was overwhelming.
One person who stood up and started talking about making a strategic plan to really get some stuff accomplished, and it sounded really reasonable. So I was like, I'm just following that guy around, and it ended up being Tim.
Tim Inglesby was a graduate student who worked as a firefighter for the Forest Service in the summer. Not to give away the ending of the story, but he and Katya are now married, and he's with us in their living room. Tim had heard about the logging through friends. He knew that being there was risking his summer job, but he couldn't handle what the clear cuts did to the forest.
Those are the proverbial moonscapes. It's just nothing but, you know, scorched earth. This is not why I wanted to work for the Forest Service. I want to do Forest Service, and this is quite the opposite.
So the night before Easter, while Stefan was calling his cutters, Tim was helping lead the resistance. All they had to do was hold off the loggers 2 or 3 days until other environmentalists could file an injunction against the timber sale in court.
And if they can lay the trees down before the case went to court, the judge would moot the case because, he might have deemed it an illegal timber sale, but he can't order the trees to be stood back up. So we call it at the time chainsaw justice.
Chainsaw justice, meaning the loggers' chainsaws got to be judge, jury, and executioner. The protesters stayed up all night, dragging fallen logs and rocks from the forest and piling them on the road. Anything that would slow down the logging trucks and snowmobiles come morning.
Well, I was thinking build a wall between the two barriers of cars, too.
We built these immense barricades. And when, dawn's rising, you just see the work. It's okay, the loggers will never get through that.
And the loggers didn't. They actually went home that first day after talking with the protesters. But then the Forest Service showed up with a front-end loader. Think bulldozer.
And within minutes, smashed the handiwork of all of us that took hours to build.
When they came in with the machinery, I realized I was a little out of my depth, and I got very scared. So I just ran up the road, and I had no idea what I was going to find. What I ended up finding was this man, Leo, in the middle of the logging road, trying to bury himself in this pyramid of rocks. And he started yelling at me, help me, help me.
Yeah, buried right up to his neck in a barricade of boulders. And that is what held off that front end loader. If the blade came right up to him, intimidating him, but he couldn't move. So it fended him off for that the rest of that day.
You want to be carried out or do you want to walk out?
The deputies set to work, moving the rocks and pulling Leo out. Deputies arrested him and 12 others on disorderly conduct that day. But as word spread, more people arrived to take their place.
Similar actions have been taking place all through the 80s, but in very remote places, but just a handful of people. This was at Brighton Bush Hot Springs on the doorstep of Portland. So there were dozens and dozens of people coming. Hear the news, we're going to go save the forest.
Despite the reinforcements, Tim and Katya still felt like they were up against the unstoppable juggernaut of the timber industry and the federal government.
How are we, this little ragged band of individuals with very little resources, how are we going to stop this terrible machine that's really, in the span of just a few years, taking the very last parts of the forest?
The irony of human psychology is that while the environmentalists felt like they were the proverbial David in the fight against Goliath, the local loggers and their families felt that way too. rightly or wrongly, they saw these scrappy protesters as representatives of big national environmental groups. Groups that were about to put all future timber sales in national forests on hold, all across the Northwest. So for the loggers, it was like their very existence was under attack.
Stefan, how are you doing?
I wanted to know what was at stake in the fight over the forests, besides the old growth. So I went to see Stefan, who was hired to cut the trees.
Kind of dirty out here.
We start out back at the shed where he stores his chainsaws.
This is pretty much as small a saw as we use.
It's bright orange and the size of what you buy at the hardware store.
32-inch bar. That's what we use every day.
And this but then he reaches into the back of the shed and he pulls out a big white mechanical box with two handles. It's so big, I would have guessed it was a portable generator, but it's actually the body of his first chainsaw. A McCullough 125. It's just missing the saw bar or the long steel plate that the chain whips around to cut into the trees.
I could run a 50-inch bar, 4-foot bar pretty much. I should clean the damn thing up.
And is that about as big of a bar as were ever used?
We use some bigger ones, some 60-inch bars occasionally.
Imagine that for a minute. A chainsaw that's big enough to get on all the rides at Disneyland. How big a tree needs a 5-foot-long chainsaw?
But I've got some pictures in it. I'll show you some big trees. I've dug them out.
Stefan takes me back inside and opens a picture album of the trees they cut at the North Roaring Devil Sale. The photos show a couple of loggers in helmets and red suspenders standing on top of a fallen log.
These things are enormous. He's standing on a tree that is as tall as... Oh, wait, is that you?
Yeah, that's me.
You're standing on a tree that is as wide as you are tall.
Oh, yeah. There was some huge timber up there that was from 5 to 7, 8 foot on the stump.
That means 8 feet wide at the base. These were the kind of trees Stefan cut all through the 70s and the 80s. He spent every day in the woods, rain or shine, sick or injured.
What did you love about it?
Oh, back then, I liked being outdoors. I hunted, I fished, and it was a feeling of freedom out there because you might work for somebody else, but when you're out there working, you're your own boss.
You also make good money without needing a college degree.
When I was 23 years old, I was making between $25,000 and $30,000 a year. And hell, I thought I was really making big money, you know.
Timber was the economic lifeblood of all the small towns in the San Ym Canyon and many of the small towns throughout the Northwest. If you didn't have a job at the mill or in the woods, you had a family member or a neighbor who did. And your kids probably played on a baseball team sponsored by the local timber company.
It was a good, you know, then it was a good feeling. In the 70s and 80s, we figured, God, we're going to do this forever.
Stefan planned to log until he retired. He even built up a business that employed nearly 30 cutters. But environmentalists wanted to keep Stefan from ever cutting trees again, or at least these ancient ones. So back at the North Roaring Devil Sale, when the loggers returned on the second morning, their wives and families came out in support.
Save our loggers! Save our loggers!
Their main goal was countering the protesters' message to the news cameras.
This is our livelihood. This puts food on our tables.
For both sides, the clock was ticking. The judge would decide whether to halt the logging the next day. So the question was, would there be any trees left standing for him to rule on? The loggers and law enforcement started up the final stretch of plowed road, led by the Forest Service's front-end loader.
We kind of went in a caravan, all went together because these people were on the sides of the road and up in the hills. And this one guy, he jumped up off the side of the road and got right in my face and threw some mud and then spit in my face too. And I was mad. And I stopped the pickup and Jim Morgan said, just sit here, just take it. I said, you just don't know how hard that is to take.
Meanwhile, Tim knew they couldn't stop the convoy, so he ran up the road into the deeper snow, where the loggers would have to continue on snowmobiles.
And then one by one, other people started joining me, and we say, let's make our stand here, and at that, right at that moment, we hear the whine of a snowmobile. So we just held hands like paper dolls that spread out across the road, and sure enough, it was a snowmobile carrying the county sheriff. And he was like standing up on the back, and he jumps off and says, you're all under arrest. And he actually handcuffed us together, holding hands. And it was the most bizarre moment, because he steps back and then realizes, oh, there's one of me and five or six of you, and you're all handcuffed together and still blocking the road. So the sheriffs have been doing all the arrests up to that point, and the Forest Service is out of the camera view, stand behind. But that required a bunch of Forest Service people to, you know, we had laid down in the snow and they had to drag us out. To me, that was just shocking, the lengths that the agency was going to try to preempt the court case. I mean, it was just kind of a mad rush to get those trees cut down.
On Tuesday, 2 days after the protest started, a federal judge heard the environmentalists' challenge. Like many justices in Oregon, he was widely regarded as sympathetic to the industry, so his ruling came as no surprise.
A federal district judge in Portland, Oregon, today rejected a request by conservationists that he block logging on a stand of centuries-old trees.
Protesters kept trying to slow the logging. They experimented with climbing into the branches and locking themselves around the trunks in a human chain with bike locks. But eventually, Stefan and the other loggers finished cutting down the remaining trees, which is why environmentalists took to calling it the Easter Massacre. But unlike the smaller protests that had come before, this time the nation paid attention. The North Roaring Devil Sale got covered by the likes of Good Morning America, The Today Show, and NPR.
Loggers and environmentalists in Oregon are locked in a battle over a stand of ancient trees. The Bugaboo Logging
That was the first time that at least public opinion radically shifted. We weren't a bunch of eco-terrorists in the woods. We were upholding the law and, you know, defending what was irreplaceable.
And it is really the action that put old growth logging in ancient forests on the map. It really helped form the movement and inform our tactics.
These tactics were just the beginning. Environmentalists had an ace up their sleeve that would prove more powerful than 100 protesters in the woods.
Environmentalists are accused of turning the Endangered Species Act into a terrorist weapon to kill off the timber industry.
How an owl swooped in to save the trees and reshape the timber industry. That's ahead on Reveal.
Reveal is brought to you by Things That Go Boom. Is Biden's foreign policy for the middle class simply slapping a little lipstick and climate change on Trump's America First agenda, or creating something truly revolutionary? Grab a beer and join host Lacey Healy and guests as she explores the kind of structural changes that would have to take place to make this country one that truly works for the middle class. Find Things That Go Boom wherever you listen to podcasts.
You might have learned that the Emancipation Proclamation and Union victories ended slavery in America. But there's so much more to that story. Seizing Freedom is a new podcast from VPM and Witness Docs that uses firsthand accounts to show how Black people defined freedom for themselves during the Civil War and Reconstruction. Listen to Seizing Freedom now on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, the SiriusXM app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Throughout the 80s, environmentalists kept losing. They could slow down logging in old-growth forests with protests and lawsuits, but in the end, most of it got cut. There just weren't that many laws that protected trees, but there were laws that protected animals. So with the last old-growth forest on the line, a few conservationists got creative. Aaron Scott from the Timber Wars podcast at Oregon Public Broadcasting picks it up from here.
Environmentalists like to say there isn't an Endangered Ecosystems Act, but there is an Endangered Species Act. So this idea started percolating that they could protect the old-growth forests by protecting an animal that needed those forests to survive. Fortunately for them, scientists had identified one such animal, the northern spotted owl. The timber industry recognized how dangerous this idea was and tried to nip it in the bud. So it laid on the pressure with politicians, government agencies, even conservation groups like the National Wildlife Federation.
The Weyerhaeuser Company had threatened to close all of its lands to hunters and fishermen nationwide. So that was somewhat persuasive because the National Wildlife Federation at that time was mostly hunters and fishermen.
This is Andy Stahl. He worked for the National Wildlife Federation, and he was one of the first to want to pursue a strategy saving the northern spotted owl. But his bosses wanted him to drop it so bad, they fired him.
They fired me on Friday. They rehired me the following Monday, subject to the following constraints. You are to make no outgoing phone calls. You are to sign no correspondence. You are to attend no meetings. We'll continue to pay you to do nothing at all.
The reasons environmentalists were afraid of going after the owl were complicated. First off, they were worried that they'd lose, and then they wouldn't have any leverage, even if it was just the threat of going to court. But in many ways, winning was an even bigger fear, especially if they used the Endangered Species Act. Because while the act was passed almost unanimously, the perception was that it was designed to protect big, beloved animals, bald eagles and blue whales and things like that. The fear among leading conservationists was that stretching it to apply to things like tiny fish and reclusive birds might get them what they want in the short term, but the backlash could lead to the death of the law.
There were concerns that the spotted owl was a bridge too far, and that it would bring down the whole Endangered Species Act. And environmentalism writ large would die.
But Andy thought he saw a way to protect the owl without putting a target on the Endangered Species Act. So he went to work for the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund. We now know it as Earth Justice. And they decided to go straight at the agency that had power over most of the remaining old growth, the U.S. Forest Service. At the time, the Forest Service was saying that you only needed 500 nesting pairs of owls to maintain genetic diversity, and each pair needed 1,000 acres. So do the math, and you are only going to protect, at most, 500,000 acres. That's just 1% of the forest land around where spotted owls lived. And that left Andy with a question.
What was the basis for saying that 500 pairs of spotted owls were sufficient to maintain a sustainable population?
Did I read it was based on a study of fruit flies?
Yeah, well, the 500 was. It was remarkable. A government document, a Forest Service document, said 500. Parentheses. Personal communication, M. Sule. Person's name. And that was it. That was the authoritative citation for saying 500. I didn't know who M. Sule was. This was before Google. So I looked around. It turned out it was a guy named Michael Sule at the University of California at Santa Cruz. So I called him up. I said, you've been cited as the authority behind protecting 500 pairs of spotted owls, which would be a substantial reduction from the current number. He said, I have? I never said that. Well, what did you say, Michael? Well, the Forest Service called me up and we talked a bit, and I told them that they should go look at a paper that a colleague of mine wrote in which he studied fruit fly mating in a jar and found that if you have 500 fruit flies, they are randomly mating in the jar, and that's a sufficiently large population to prevent a particular bristle hair mutation from becoming fixed in the population and taking over.
Oh, I asked Michael, what does that have to do with spotted owls? He said nothing at all. It has nothing to do with spotted owls.
So 500 pairs came from a leap of logic straight out of eighth grade biology. It was junk. But Andy couldn't halt logging until he had a better number, and no one had done that science. Andy would have to find someone and put them on the case. A cross-country search eventually led him to the evolutionary biologist, Russell Landy, in Maine.
I remember sitting in a lobster shack on the coast of Maine, and Russ says, I've been thinking about your owl question. And he grabs a butter-soaked paper napkin and starts writing formulas on it, which is all Greek to me. And he says, you know, this is how I'll go about solving it. And he starts explaining it to me. And it was really quite elegant what he'd done.
What Russell Landy had done was build on the math that one of his professors had developed for the Farm Bureau to help eliminate pests. Basically, his professor had modeled how many bugs you had to kill to wipe out an infestation, such that the bug population couldn't recover and recolonize the crop.
What Russ did was he took that mathematics and flipped it on its head.
But if you ran the numbers the other direction, you could figure out how many owls you needed to keep alive in order to ensure that they recovered and recolonized the forest. All the variables were basically the same. You needed to know how far an animal will travel to mate, their odds of finding each other, and their reproduction and survival rates. Plug that into the equation, and you can figure out how much forest you need to be confident that every time an owl dies, a new one is born. Landy's math showed that owls as a whole couldn't survive in a landscape unless about a quarter of it was mature old forest. And that meant, if we wanted to keep the owl alive, we'd have to stop cutting old growth almost immediately. So in 1989, they filed an injunction against the U.S. Forest Service.
Well, I walked up the hill downtown Seattle to the federal district courthouse, walked into the clerk's office, and presented it to her. She looked at the caption, and she said, I've been expecting this.
This was a complicated lawsuit. On its face, it was about spotted owls, but it was really about old growth. But it was really, really about finding out whether the government was breaking the law, or the law itself was broken. The first law in question was the National Environmental Policy Act. Its main requirement is that the government tell the truth and disclose the consequences of its decisions. Team Andy's contention was that by underplaying the spotted owl's population requirements, by sticking to the number 500, it wasn't telling the truth. The other half of the lawsuit was based on another law, the National Forest Management Act.
And it says the plan that you adopt for managing these forests has to protect the survival, the viability of all native vertebrate species.
The core of their argument hung on just this one sentence. But it gave all the power to scientists, not politicians or timber executives, to determine what constitutes a viable population. And basically it meant you can't knowingly drive an animal to extinction.
We said, look, these plans don't do it. Because spotted owls are not fruit flies.
So what was the ruling?
Yeah, the ruling was, preliminary injunction granted.
The ruling was like a bomb that exploded across the Northwest.
The U.S. Forest Service has stopped all timber sales in 13 national forests in Oregon and Washington. The decision affects nearly 5 billion board feet of timber.
And it wasn't just one decision. The Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund also filed lawsuits against the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. By the time they were done, all three agencies had to step up their owl protections. And that meant putting most new timber sales in federal forests on hold.
There used to be a time when old-growth forests stretched across parts of the Middle East, Europe, and most of the U.S., but people cut them down so long ago that most of us don't even remember they were there. This was the last chance to save the ancient forests of the Pacific Northwest. But it came at a cost.
You know, when you go from being a logger to flipping hamburgers down at McDonald's, it wasn't a very good deal.
That's next on Reveal.
Reveal is brought to you by Progressive. Are you thinking more about how to tighten up your budget these days? Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average, and customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts when they sign up. A little off your rate each month goes a long way. Get a quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed in 2020. Potential savings will vary. Discounts vary and are not available in all states and situations.
I'm Amy Mustafa, the production manager here at Reveal. Reveal is a nonprofit news organization, and we rely on support from listeners like you. Become a member by texting the word REVEAL to 474747. Standard data rates apply, and you can text STOP at any time. Again, text REVEAL to 474747. Thank you.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is REVEAL. I'm Al Edson. If you roll out a map of the Pacific Northwest and put your finger down in any of the national forests, chances are that in the 1980s, the nearest small towns depended on timber from that forest. Earlier in the show, we told you about the Easter Massacre, where strands of old-growth trees were cut down in Oregon's Willamette National Forest. If you were to put your finger down there, the biggest nearby town would be Mill City, where really, the name says it all. So when it came down to saving old-growth forests and the animals that live in them, it meant places like Mill City would pay a price. Here's Oregon Public Broadcasting reporter Aaron Scott again with the show we originally aired in February.
I was told that if you wanted to talk to some of the old-timers who logged in the 80s during the end of the old-growth bonanza, you should head to the Mountain Cafe at 5 a.m., on a Thursday. At this hour, the place is empty, except for one table in the corner.
This is the Romeo Club. Retired old men eating out.
This week's meeting of the Romeo Club counts two retired loggers, one retired mill manager, one retired butcher, and two retired government foresters. The group is sitting around a big circular table, waiting for their food. And true to form, there's a lot of flannel and suspenders to go around.
How long have you guys been meeting here on Thursdays?
10 years?
Yeah. There's probably more than that.
There's been a coffee shop discussion table since I moved here in 74. And I know it was going on long before that.
But back then, it wasn't just retired guys. In its heyday, Mill City had a couple cafes like this that would be full of loggers first thing in the morning, stopping in to fill up on coffee and eggs on their way into the woods.
You know, everybody was here at least one day a week. Some people here were 6 or 5. It changed.
It changed. Now the loggers in the black and white photos, hanging on the walls, outnumber the ones getting breakfast. And that decline began with those first court rulings in 1989.
Did it feel like it changed? The forest got locked up overnight, or was it more of a
It wasn't process? Gradual. It was just instant. Yeah, like as soon as that happened, important. It was over.
An instant isn't a huge exaggeration. The protests and court rulings over the owl all came within months of each other. It felt like a landslide suddenly crashing down on the community. And a PR battle was being waged in the media, one that many folks in timber communities felt like they were losing to a bunch of old trees and scruffy environmentalists. So pro-timber groups began to put out pamphlets and press releases and organize rallies in towns up and down the Northwest. If there was a court hearing, they were outside it with signs. If there was a political event, they were circling the block with their logging trucks.
A crowd of over 8,000 people jammed Pioneer Courthouse Square in downtown Portland for a pro-timber rally. Workers from all around the state were given the day off to protest proposed logging cutbacks.
We're talking about jobs.
Right. Okay, but there's also
we're talking about kids.
There's also the future too.
Environmental.
Right now, it's important.
Having problems with this owl. They're saying that this owl.
It is a problem.
Okay. But it wasn't just loggers versus environmentalists. Rural versus urban. The timber wars started splitting small towns apart too, and no one experienced it more than Sherry Girard.
Then I guess we'll go in my office.
Sherry runs a nonprofit in Mill City that deals with everything from domestic violence to counseling out-of-work loggers. She comes from a third-generation timber family, and her husband, Jim Girard, owns a local grocery store.
He was riding bicycles across the United States with his son for Dornbecker Hospital, and somebody went and put out the rumor that he was a part of the eco-terrorists. And why would anybody shop his store?
Just because he liked bicycle riding?
Just because he liked bicycle riding. That's something that they do. It was a war. You were either on one side or you were on the other side.
So Sherry jumped into action. She printed up T-shirts for the staff that said, "We support the timber industry." She called the mill owners and reassured them her husband was on their side. She even spoke at a rally about how the community needed to stand together and not turn on each other.
And we finally got it settled.
It's almost mind-boggling to me that they would be so focused on even just one business with the idea that, oh, you might be sympathetic.
People were hurting that bad, and they were that scared, and they were that upset, and they were looking for somebody to blame. If anybody wasn't on our side, then you were definitely the enemy.
But one scapegoat rose above everything else, the northern spotted owl. Just as it became the mascot and the legal linchpin for the environmentalists, it became a symbol of everything the logging communities hated and feared.
I don't think any of us want to see the spotted owl become extinct, but if it's us or the owl, then I don't care what happens to him.
Folks started making bumper stickers and T-shirts that said things like, "Save a logger, eat an owl," and "Spotted owl tastes like chicken."
If you thought it was the 25-cent drafts that brought this crowd to the town tavern this evening, you're wrong. These loggers came for the Spotted Owl dinner special.
Aren't you worried you might be eating the last of an endangered species here?
Yeah, it is really worrying me because I'm an endangered species.
Of course, the meat really was chicken. But remember how some environmentalists didn't even want to try to list the spotted owl under the Endangered Species Act because they feared it could backfire on the law and that it would distract from the fight to protect ancient forests. Well, it kinda did. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service finally listed the northern spotted owl as threatened on June 22, 1990. And the backlash was immediate.
Environmentalists are accused of turning the Endangered Species Act into a terrorist weapon to kill off the timber industry.
It's a disaster. They're gonna shut the mills like this in Oregon and Washington down. Period.
It's nothing more than a glorified barn owl.
The irony is that the Endangered Species Act wasn't really what locked up the old growth to begin with. It was the other somewhat confusing environmental laws that Andy Stahl and the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund used. But for some reason, everyone has always blamed the Endangered Species Act. Maybe it was the fear that it would also lock up private forests. And maybe it's the fact that instead of playing out in legal briefs and courtrooms, it played out on nightly news and in public hearings, as the Reagan and Bush administrations fought against their own scientists and judges in a multi-year tug-of-war over whether or not to list the bird.
They had the hearings, and they had the hearings for the spotted owl thing.
Tom Fensel was one of the retired loggers around the table at the Romeo Club. I went to see him afterward at his home.
Waited in line for 2 hours to testify. Get in there and look over at the panel. That really made me mad. And half of them were gone or they were sleeping.
Oh, no, because it's so many people were testifying that
it took me all day, probably 1,000. I don't, maybe more than 1,000. when I got up there to testify, I said, well, you people ought to have a decency to at least wake up and listen rather than either be gone or sleeping. Well, that didn't go over very big, but it didn't change nothing.
That sense of not having any say over your own future, that sense of not even being listened to when you're asking for help, that festers and it grows. And in this case, it turned the Endangered Species Act into the poster child for government overreach, a status it holds to this day. Because never before had the protection of a single animal affected so many people, especially a motley owl that hides in the dank forest like a criminal. So the Endangered Species Act became the villain that got all the blame. And just as environmentalists feared, calls to repeal it echoed all the way from cafes in Mill City to the White House.
I will not sign an extension of the Endangered Species Act unless it gives greater consideration to jobs, to families, and to communities. It is time to make people more important than owls.
While conservative politicians have never succeeded in getting rid of the Endangered Species Act, the backlash to it did win one major victory for the timber industry. After being portrayed as the villains cutting down America's last ancient forests, the logging side managed to flip the script so that they were the underdogs.
Now, owls versus loggers in the Pacific Northwest.
As they made their case, both sides were throwing all sorts of numbers around.
250,000 jobs in the West.
Environmentalists call these figures by the National Forest Products Association outrageous.
Exactly how many jobs are at stake is a matter of considerable dispute.
10 to 15%, that's all.
But it was a lot more complicated than owls versus jobs. The timber industry was already undergoing massive changes that had nothing to do with the owl. An economic recession in the early 1980s drove a lot of mills out of business, and those that survived adopted new technology that resulted in even more layoffs.
In the 1970s, it took 7 mill workers to turn 1 million board feet of logs into lumber. In today's modern computerized mills, the same amount of timber creates 2 jobs or less.
The recession hammered the final nail in the coffin of what had once been thriving timber unions in the Northwest. And then there was the issue of exports. Timber companies were exporting raw logs overseas without milling them here first, which meant they were exporting those mill jobs too.
Some workers, including those who have already lost their jobs, say the real problem is in exporting raw logs.
That is going...
Well, I lost my job, Freddie, and that's a cover-up. It's not the owl.
It's
not
the owl.
I'll tell you what, it is real.
Over the course of the 80s, even before the owl, timber jobs that had once paid a premium turned into average wage jobs. These were just like the changes that were reshaping other industries like farming, mining, and manufacturing. But there's one big difference. The timber industry was able to pin most of its problems on the spotted owl and environmentalists because the owl did hurt the industry. After the government came up with a plan to protect the spotted owl and other old-growth-dependent species, logging in federal forests dropped by more than 80%.
It decimated a lot of communities.
This is Stephen Weaver again. The logger we met at the beginning of the hour.
It was real bad. It was bad on me. I mean, I went from, let's say, just having a good job to no job for a while. But, you know, I picked myself up and, well, I didn't. I was really mad at the world. In the late 90s era, I kind of hated everybody that didn't like the trees to be cut. You know, when you go from being a logger that makes $40,000 a year, maybe back then $50,000, to flipping hamburgers down at McDonald's, it wasn't a very good deal.
Whether it was a good deal or not depends largely on where you call home. Today, a third of timber towns are economically worse off, but a third have stayed the same, in part because there's still a massive amount of logging happening on private land. Another third are better off than before, because they have managed to play off the beauty of the national forests around them to attract tourism, recreation, and new businesses. As for the timber wars, they didn't end. They just evolved. Now, instead of fighting over just old-growth forests, we're fighting over all the forests, because they play a huge role in combating climate change. Forests absorb and store carbon. They regulate and filter drinking water. And many of the animals that depend on them, like the spotted owl, are even more threatened than ever. So now environmentalists want to protect all publicly owned forests, not just the old ones. But we're also fighting over them because they're burning. One side thinks to make things better, we should be cutting more trees and putting out fires. The other side thinks logging and suppressing the fires that historically burn these forests has made things worse. The timber industry and environmentalists are still operating with two completely different worldviews. That old saying, you can't see the forest for the trees? Well, here, the fight feels even more basic. The two sides can't even agree on what a forest is, or what it's for, or most importantly, what's our role in it. After decades of fighting, the battle lines are the same, but the stakes are even higher.
In January, days before leaving office, the Trump administration slashed protections for the northern spotted owl, reclassifying nearly 3.5 million acres of land designated as critical habitat. But that move is on hold while the Biden administration reviews the ruling. Today's show came to us from the podcast Timber Wars. It's from Oregon Public Broadcasting, and it explores so much more about the wonders of the forest and the consequences of this battle. You can find Timber Wars wherever you get your podcasts. It will change the way you see forests. This episode was reported by Aaron Scott and produced by Aaron, Peter Frickwright, and Robbie Carver. David Steves, Ed Yawn, and Brett Myers edited the show. Fact-checking by Matt Giles. For archival audio, thanks to NPR and the KEZI-TV Chambers Communication Corporation collection at the University of Oregon Libraries. Special thanks to NPR Storylab. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mustafa. Laura, my favorite Gibson, composed the music for today's show. Sound design by Robbie Carver and audio engineering by Stephen Cray, along with Jay Breezy, Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.
From PRX.